Hi, and welcome to the Colby Visiting Writer Series. Few reminders. Our next reading is December 7th, Pearl Harbor Day, in spite of what George Bush said. This is the real Pearl Harbor Day. And our own Jim Boylan will be reading, trumpeting the arrival of his new book of stories, Remind Me to Murder You Later, and the fall issue of the Pequod, in this very room at this very time. On Sunday, March 12th, the poet Gerald Stern, author of Lucky Life and Paradise Poems, will be reading. And a reminder that following this reading, we shall have our infamous cheap wine and pretzel reception in the English seminar room for our distinguished poet to show him just what a class act we are. There you'll be able to speak with Mr. Muldoon and ask him such questions as, do you write with a typewriter or a pen? I hope someone will ask him that anyway. Okay. We're fortunate indeed to welcome tonight the Irish poet Paul Muldoon. Muldoon shares with other Irish poets the gift of music and rhythm, the pleasures of storytelling, although I found today that a lot of the pleasures of storytelling actually come from that great Irish poet Robert Frost. And Mr. Muldoon comes with an elegant vocabulary mixed with a sensual love of the earthly. I particularly admire, though, the range of his vision, his capacity to give voice to issues as intimate as the family, as social as a war-torn, occupied country, as metaphysical as grief, as playful as the spirit of language, as material and animal as the smoldering, red-hot half-brick of the family water bottle, a man's hand on a woman's breast. Additionally, as a writer, I admire his capacity for surprise, for turning familiar subjects into arresting, energetic, and volatile experiences, and for grounding completely surreal experience in the world of the familiar. Anyone who can write a serious comic poem about Pancho Villa, mention Lord Byron and Raymond Chandler in the same stanza, has an imagination worthy of envy. The English poet Michael Hoffman in the Times Literary Supplement has called Muldoon the most charismatic poet writing in England and Ireland today. Seamus Heaney has praised him as the most promising poet to appear in Ireland for years. He's the author of 5 collections of poetry, including Meeting the British, Mules, and Why Brownlee Left, and his selected poems, hold up book at this point, is in our very bookstore, published by the prestigious Echo Press. The son of a commercial mushroom grower, he was born in Armagh Island and Ireland, not the island, but the Ireland, and has been a producer for BBC. Currently, he's teaching at Columbia and Princeton. Please welcome the poet Paul Muldoon.
Thank you very much indeed. There are a few seats up here at the front if you want to come up and get yourself settled. I'm going to read for about 45 or 50 minutes, something like that, if that's not too alarming. I thought I'd begin with a poem about my father, who, when he was a young man, are you happy enough there? Do you want to come up? Decided that he would leave Northern Ireland, County Tyrone, about halfway across Northern Ireland, where he'd been brought up. This was sometime during the 1930s when things were bad. That he would leave there and head off for Australia, as it turned out. And he went about this in a rather strange way, in that he arranged with a friend of his that they would set off together for Australia, that they would meet at a crossroads somewhere in County Tyrone at, say, 12 o'clock on Sunday or whenever it was, and that they would set off together for Belfast in the boat to Australia. So my father arrived at 12 o'clock. His friend hadn't turned up. He waited around for an hour, Still no sign of his friend. 2 o'clock, still nothing doing. So he turned round and went home again and stayed there more or less for the rest of his life. Apart from the occasional little sally across the Irish Sea, he worked in England on building sites, for example. In any case, I got to thinking about this, about the very random nature of so many of the decisions we take or think we're taking along the way. And in this poem, I've tried to, on one hand, describe the life he did lead, as I say, going over to England from time to time. On the other, I imagine a life that he might have led. And I have him setting off not for Australia, but for some reason for Argentina. Australia seemed not really a place, even in retrospect, for him to have been heading towards. I suppose he might have come to Boston or Belfast, Maine. I don't know. In any case, leading a life where he might have met perhaps another woman, perhaps at an entirely different set of children, perhaps not, who's to know. In any case, this is a very long introduction to a very short poem, and I'll try to curtail myself as we go along. So this is a little snapshot of a moment that might have been. I too have trailed my father's spirit from the mud-walled cabin behind the mountain where he was born and bred. TB and Scarlatina. The farm where he was first hired out. To Wigan, to Crewe Junction. A building site from which he disappeared and took passage almost for Argentina. The mountain is coming down with hazel. The building site, a slum, while he has gone no further than Brazil. That's him on the veranda, drinking rum with a man who might be a Nazi. His children asleep under their mosquito nets. As I say, I did stay around Northern Ireland, County Tyrone. And I was brought up, first place I remember was a little house in a place called Eglish in County Tyrone. Eglish, a corruption of the Irish word Aglish, a church. And there my father kept a little shop where he sold various bits and pieces. Not exactly everything from a needle to an anchor, but quite a number of the things along the way. And one of the things that we were especially interested in as kids was the range of sweets or candy that he kept very high up on one particular shelf. And in particular, a sweet called Clove Rock. It was a very sticky, clove-tasting, horrible confection. I don't think you get it in this part of the world. Sort of hesitate to say what this poem might be about, but if it's about anything, it might be some idea of a kind of terror of pre-recognition, which sounds, I know, very corny, and indeed is very corny. In other words, what I'm thinking about is the possibility of knowing at an age or a stage something about the world that one might not decently be expected to know at that age, at say the age of 3 or 4. What it would mean to understand, say, the significance of a word in this case. The right arm. I was 3-ish when I plunged my arm into the sweet jar for the last bit of Clove Rock. We kept a shop in Eglish that sold bread, milk, butter, cheese, bacon and eggs, Andrew's liver salts, and until now, Clove Rock. I would give my right arm to have known then how Eglish was itself wedged between Ecclesia and Eglise. The Eglish sky was its own stained glass vault, and my right arm was sleeved in glass that has yet to shatter. You notice some people have remarked on the tendency of some of these poems to stop really rather than end, which is something that I hope you might get used to. The hope is that they ripple on. They're not all like that, thank God. But the hope is that they might ripple on a little bit after that. It's another more recent poem about a right arm or an extension of a right arm. Are you happy? Do you want to come up and sit at the front? Or it's a poem set at a bus stop on East 79th Street, actually, in New York. I was standing there one day with a briefcase, or rather a gaudy briefcase that somebody gave me. Just a thing for a young executive. Purple, covered with eel skin, made in Taiwan, covered with little strips of eel sewn together. Just an open invitation to trouble. Standing there, as I say, at this bus stop with this item and having a little tremor. An obol, if you remember, is the little coin or token that they used to place on your eyes or tongue sometimes as you crossed the Styx. Probably still do. The briefcase. I held the briefcase at arm's length from me. The ox blood or liver eel skin with which it was covered had suddenly grown supple. I'd been waiting in line for the crosstown bus when an almighty cloudburst left the sidewalk a raging torrent. And though all it contained was the first inkling of this poem, I knew I daren't set the briefcase down to slap my pockets for an obol, for fear it might slink into a culvert and strike out along the East River for the sea, by which I mean the open sea. There wasn't a great deal happening in the little village outside which I was brought up on the Armagh-Tyrone border. We didn't have poetry readings or any of that kind of stuff. What we did have, though, was a cinema. And we used to troop out there every Saturday, perhaps a couple of times a week. And this was in the late 50s, early 60s, when it seemed that every week Hollywood was turning out one, if not two, westerns, with Audie Murphy and Gene Autry and various other people, Ronnie Reagan, I guess, riding about in and out of the sunset. This poem about going to the cinema expecting a Western and having a bit of a shock. The Weepies. Most Saturday afternoons at the local hippodrome saw the Pathy News rooster, then the recurring dream of a lonesome drifter through uninterrupted range. Will Hunter, so gifted he could peel an orange in a single fluent gesture, was the leader of our gang. The curtain rose this afternoon on a lion, not a gong. When the crippled girl who wanted to be a dancer, met the married man who was dying of cancer. Our hankies unfurled like flags of surrender. I believe something fell asunder in even Will Hunter's hands.
There's a problem about the impact of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
The little parish of College Lands. And the impact was considerable. And what happened was that everyone round about joined, and this is a little Catholic parish, everyone joined the queue at the church for the confessional. Since this was it coming up, and clearly they had to get their act together with their maker. There's a reference in the poem to Patton, General Patton, who after the war made a tour of Europe thanking various European countries for having looked after the US soldiers during the war. So, this is a poem about a very, very close-run thing. A near miss, a near hit. Cuba. My eldest sister arrived home that morning in her white muslin evening dress. Who the hell do you think you are, running out to dances in next to nothing? As though we hadn't enough bothering with the world at war, if not at an end. My father was pounding the breakfast table. Those Yankees were touch and go as it was, if you'd heard Patton in Armagh. But this Kennedy's nearly an Irishman, so he's not much better than ourselves. And him with only to say the word. If you've got anything on your mind, maybe you should make your peace with God. I could hear May from beyond the curtain. Bless me, Father, for I am sinned. I told a lie once. I was disobedient once. And Father, a boy touched me once. Tell me, child, was this touch immodest? Did he touch your breast, for example? He brushed against me, Father, very gently. My mother was a school teacher, and which meant that we, her children, were had no option but to go out to school with her in the morning. But there were people around about who seemed to have made other arrangements, and very rarely showed at all. And this is a poem by one of them, who, if he did appear, it was something of an occasion. About his life, then and now, perhaps. Joseph Mary Plunkett, after whom this man is named, was a poet, if you remember. He was one of the leaders of the 1916 Rising in Dublin. And the poem is a Gaelic title, the meaning of which I hope will become clear in a second. Anshaw, Anshaw. When the master was calling the roll at the primary school in College Lands, you were meant to call back Anshaw and raise your hand as your name occurred. Anshaw meaning here, here and now, all present and correct, was the first word of Irish I spoke. The last name on the ledger belonged to Joseph Mary Plunkett Ward, and was followed, as often as not, by silence, knowing looks, a nod and a wink, the master's droll, and where's our little ward of court? I remember the first time he came back, the master had sent him out along the hedges to weigh up for himself and cut a stick with which he would be beaten. After a while, nothing was spoken. He would arrive as a matter of course with an ash plant, a sally rond, or finally the hazel wand he had whittled down to a whiplash. Its twist of red and yellow lacquers, sanded and polished, and altogether so delicately wrought that he had engraved his initials on it. I last met Joseph Mary Plunkett Ward in a pub just over the Irish border. He was living in the open, in a secret camp on the other side of the mountain. He was fighting for Ireland, making things happen. And he told me, Joe Ward, of how he had risen through the ranks to quartermaster, commandant, how every morning at parade his volunteers would call back Anshaw and raise their hands as their names occurred. It seemed for a long time every Sunday in life we had a family outing to a graveyard of some description. This was a popular way of spending Sunday afternoon. My family, and indeed among a number of families round about, nothing guilish or just a way of putting in a few hours. Can never quite work out what the attraction was. I suppose that you could go along and talk about the dead, the ex-neighbours, I guess. I really don't know. But in any case, for a long time we depended on a neighbour or one particular uncle for a ride on these jaunts. Then, sometime in the mid-60s, we got a car of our own, and everything was suddenly possible. The world began to open up in all sorts of marvellous ways. And the first trip we took in this car was to a roundabout, as we call them, and here I think you call them rotaries or turning circles. Is that right? I'm sorry, I always forget this. A turning circle. A rotary. This was the first rotary or roundabout in Northern Ireland, perhaps in Ireland. And we'd heard quite a lot about it. Lots of people round about had been involved in building it. And while we had grasped it intellectually, you might say, we needed to experience it. The B specials were the second division or branch or wing of the Royal Ulster Constabulary, and they're now disbanded because of all kinds of things they got up to. Excuse me. Am I giving too much, too little by way of introduction to these poems? Okay. The Sightseers. My father and mother, my brother and sister and I, with Uncle Pat, our dear, best loved uncle, had set out that Sunday afternoon in July in his broken down Ford. Not to visit some graveyard, one died of shingles, one of fever, another's knees turned to jelly, but the brand new roundabout at Ballygolly, the first in Mid-Ulster. Uncle Pat was telling us how the B specials had stopped him one night somewhere near Ballygolly and smashed his bicycle and made him sing the sash and curse the Pope of Rome. They held a pistol so hard against his forehead, there was still the mark of an O when he got home. I think we'll have a little change of address.
There's a poem that began in a house in somewhere in upper New York State, actually. I was staying one night in a child's room, and the ceiling of the room was covered with little luminous phosphorescent stars. Have you come across these at all? And the light, they're wonderful, absolutely marvelous. And it's the first time I'd seen it. I thought it was great.
That's where it begins, though actually I moved it all down to Pennsylvania because it was easier. But then, just to complicate matters further, I
called it Ontario. It's a prose poem, as you can see. It goes right the way out there to the margins.
Ontario. I spent last night in the nursery of a house in Pennsylvania. When I put out the light, I made my way barefoot through the aftermath of Brandywine Creek. The constellations of the northern hemisphere were picked out in luminous paint on the ceiling. I lay under a comforting phosphorescent plough, thinking about where the plough stopped being the plough and became the Big Dipper. About the astronomer I met in Philadelphia who had found a star with a radio telescope. The star is now named after her, whatever her name happens to be. As all these stars grew dim, it seemed like a good time to rerun my own dream visions. They had flashed up just as I got into bed on three successive nights in 1972. The first was a close-up of a face, Cox's face, falling. I heard next morning how he had come home drunk and taken a nosedive down the stairs. Next, my Uncle Pat's face, falling in slow-mo like the first, but bloody. It turned out he had slipped off a ladder on a building site. His forehead needed 7 stitches. Lastly, a freeze-frame trickle of water or glycerin on a sheet of smoked glass or perspex. I see it in shaving mirrors, dry martinis, women's tears, on windshields as planes take off or land. I remembered how I was meant to fly to Toronto this morning to visit my younger brother. He used to be a research assistant at the University of Guelph, where he wrote a thesis on nitrogen fixing in soybeans, or symbiosis, or some such mystery. He now works for the Corn Producers Association of Ontario. On my last trip, we went to a disco in the Park Plaza, where I helped a girl in a bin liner dress to find her contact lens. Did you know that Spinoza was a lens grinder? Are you for real? Joe was somewhere in the background, sniggering, flicking cosmic dandruff from his shoulders. A lens, I went on, is really a lintel, a pulse. Her back was an imponderable green furrow in the ultraviolet strobe. Did you know that Yonge Street's the longest street in the world? I can't say that I did. Well, it starts 1,000 miles to the north, and it ends right here. It's a poem about another woman in a bin liner dress, perhaps. A poem about a journey from the southwest corner of Ireland, a place called Dingle. Perhaps some of you have been there. County Kerry. Very picturesque place. Seen Ryan's daughter, David Lynn's film, much of it was shot there. Very beautiful. a journey from there right up through Ireland to Belfast, where I lived for a long time, and gradually getting some sense of the country. I should explain perhaps that during the hunger strikes in Ireland, many towns were bedecked or festooned or covered with little black flags, often made from plastic rather than cloth or canvas or whatever you make flags from. The poem's called Christos, after that artist, whom you know has a tendency to cover great tracts of California and Florida Keys, places like that, with various materials. Christo was about to make a start, actually, on Ireland. Mm-hmm. He was about to cover St. Stephen's Green in the middle of Dublin with something. I'm not sure what it was. In fact, I discovered that after I wrote this poem. I hadn't known that, but somebody came up and told me that this had indeed been the case. So, two people in a car driving up through Ireland. Christos. Two workmen were carrying a sheet of asbestos down the main street of Dingle. It must have been nailed at a slight angle to the same sized gap between Brandon and whichever's the next mountain. 9 o'clock. We watched the village dogs take turns to spritz the hotel's refuse sacks. I remembered Tralee's unbiodegradable flags from the time of the hunger strikes. We drove all day past mounds of sugar beet, haystacks, silage pits, building sites, a thatched cottage even, all of them draped in black polythene and weighted against the northeast wind by concrete blocks, old tires, bags of sand at a makeshift army post across the border. By the time we got to Belfast, the whole of Ireland would be under wraps, like, as I said, one of your man's landscapes. Your man's? You don't mean Christo's. It's a poem about a typical Christmas day I spent until 3 years ago. My father and myself, just the two of us, having as good a time as we possibly could, and arguing very little. We didn't argue much at all, except on Christmas Day, and often over what we should be watching at any given moment on television. So on the hour and a half hour, basically. At the end of this poem, there are a couple of words missing, and I suspect they're the names of a couple of knights of the Round Table or some such figures. A couple of knights. And on the page, they're dashes. And here, there also be. It makes writing a poem a little easier. There are a couple of words fewer to think about. It makes this more difficult. The Wishbone. Maureen in England, Joseph in Guelph, my mother in her grave. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we watch the Queen's message to the Commonwealth with the sound turned off. He seems to favour Camelot over to have and have not. Yet we agree, my father and myself, that here is more than enough for two. A frozen chicken, spuns, sprouts, Paxo, sage and onion. The wishbone, like a rolled spur on the fibula of Sir or Sir. It's a poem about a rabbit I met once in a dream.
Your average rabbit?
Except this one, for some reason, mistook me for my father, whose name was Paddy Muldoon, and who, as well as growing mushrooms, a little earlier on, grew vegetables, acres of them. So a poem about a rabbit, or a coney, as in Coney Island, a coney. We used to have a Coney Island a few miles down the road from us on Loch Ney, and I always used to think about Coney Island, and where is it, Brooklyn? We'd heard about it, but we had our own Coney Island. The coney. Although I have never learned to mow, I suddenly find myself halfway through last year's pea sticks and cauliflower stalks in our half acre of garden. My father had always left the whetstone safely wrapped in his old tweed cap and balanced on one particular plank beside the septic tank. This past winter he had been too ill to work. The scythe would dull so much more quickly in my hands than his, and was so often honed that while the blade grew less and less a blade, the whetstone had entirely disappeared, and a lop-eared coney was now curled inside the cap. He whistled to me through the gap in his front teeth. I was wondering, Chief, if you happen to know the name of the cauliflowers in your cold frame that you still hope to dibble in this unenviable bit of ground. They would be all the year round, I guessed as much. With that, he swaggered along the diving board and jumped. The moment he hit the water, he lost his tattered bathing tongs to a swimming pool's pack of dongs. Come in. This flayed coney would parade and pirouette like honey on a spoon. Come on in, Paddy Muldoon. And although I have never learned to swim, I would willingly have followed him. This poem is set in the area just northwest of Detroit in the 1760s, where, if you remember, there was a spot of bother with the locals. The locals being the Ottawa, led by Pontiac, and who were creating, as you know, and something had to be done about it. This poem is spoken by, I guess, the ghost of one of these Ottawa. And if you think my English accent is a bit strange, would you hear my French accent? Meeting the British. We met the British in the dead of winter. The sky was lavender and the snow lavender blue. I could hear far below the sound of two streams coming together. Both were frozen over. And no less strange, myself calling out in French across that forest clearing. Neither General Geoffrey Amherst nor Colonel Henry Bouquet could stomach our willow tobacco. As for the unusual scent, when the Colonel shook out his handkerchief, c'est la lavande and fleur mauve comme le ciel. They gave us six fish hooks and two blankets embroidered with smallpox. This poem, I try to imagine the scene. During the first Christmas of the First World War, when, if you remember, the troops on both sides got together and had a little party in Lowlands, I can imagine what that might have been like. Sorry, can you hear me okay at the back? My voice is strange tonight, I'm sorry. Truce. It begins with one or two soldiers and one or two following, with hampers over their shoulders. They might be off wildfiring, as they would another Christmas day. So gingerly they pick their steps. No one seems sure of what to do. All stop when one stops. A fire gets lit. Some spread their greatcoats on the frozen ground. Polish vodka, fruit and bread are broken out and passed round. The air of an old German song, the rules of patience, are the secrets they'll share before long. They draw on their last cigarettes as Friday night lovers, when it's over, might get up from their mattresses to congratulate each other and exchange names and addresses. This poem about a word which I thought for years, if I thought about it at all, which wasn't really much, I thought must have been handed down from generation to generation in our family, and indeed I guess that everyone round about must have used this word also. You can see what a sheltered upbringing I had, and I suppose that it must have come from some Gaelic root, as many of the words used in Irish English do. I didn't really know. I asked my father about it, and he told me that the first time he'd heard this word was from us, his children. I'm not quite sure what we were trying to say. I only know that it came out as quiff. Quiff. How often have I carried our family word for the hot water bottle to a strange bend, as my father would juggle a red-hot half-brick in an old sock to his childhood settle. I have taken it into so many lovely hens, or laid it between us like a sword. An hotel room in New York City with a girl who spoke hardly any English, my hand on her breast like the smouldering one-off spur of the Yeti, or some other shy beast that has yet to enter the language. It's a poem about your own, the North American Yeti, I guess. Bigfoot comes, if he comes at all, among sumac and birches, stops halfway across the clearing, wood smoke, the cabin where you mourn your wife, where, darkening the tiny window, is the fur coat you promised her when she was 20 or 21, you forget. It's a poem set in a Japanese restaurant in New York, a sushi bar. few people are having a pretty terrible time, and I sometimes wonder, again, when I think about it, which isn't often, if the relationship is going to last until the end of the poem. But I suppose it must, just about. There are a couple of philosophers mentioned at the end of the poem, Duns Scotus and Scotus Erigena. The important thing, as you know, about these two guys, going to last until the end of the poem. But I suppose it must, just about. There are a couple of philosophers mentioned at the end of the poem, Duns Scotus and Scotus Erigena. The important thing, as you know, about these two guys is that you don't confuse them. Duns Scotus. Scotus, as you know, perhaps means Irish originally, and then the Irish moved over to Scotland. And the Scots find this distressing. But Erigena, it also means Irish. Scotus Erigena was a very Irish type of guy. Erigna is a place in Ireland where some mining is done. Two people in this poem, one does most of the talking, one chips in a very unhappy way from time to time. There's a bit in the poem, I'm not quite sure who speaks it, and I'm not quite sure who's going to speak it when we get to it. Sushi. Why do we spend so much time in arguing? We were sitting at the sushi bar, drinking Kirin beer, and watching the master chef fastidiously shave salmon, tuna, and yellowtail, while a slightly more volatile apprentice fanned the rice, every grain of which was magnetized in one direction, east. Then came translucent strips of octopus, squid, and conger, pickled ginger, and pale green horseradish. It's as if you have some kind of death wish. You won't even talk. On the sidewalk, a woman in a leotard with a real leopard in tow. For an instant, I saw beyond the row of sea urchins the erogenous zones of shad and sea bream. I saw, when the steam cleared, how this apprentice had scrimshandered a rose's exquisite petals, not from some precious metal or wood or stone, I might just as well be eating alone, but the tail end of a carrot. How, when he submitted this work of art to the master, is it not the height of arrogance to propose that gods no more arcane than the smack of oregano, orgone, the inner organs of beasts and fowls, the minds of Erigna, the poems of Louis Aragon? That's the bit I'm not too sure who speaks that, but he submits this work of art to the master. It might have been alabaster or jade. The master so gravely weighed from hand to hand, with the look of a man unlikely to confound Duns Scotus, say, with Scotus Erigena. I'm going to read a few short sections from a long poem that I've been working on for a while. Quite interested in writing long poems, and I've written a number of them. I don't read them generally. It's too dangerous, too boring for all concerned. I mean, even more boring. And I'll read a little bit of this one. It's called, for the moment, Madoc, 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 you might remember, was a 12th century Welsh prince who supposedly made it to North America, discovered North America. Well, I'm sure there were people before then, but he discovered it for himself. Not only that, he went back home again and got a number of people to join him and came back again and settled somewhere, nobody's quite sure, of course, where. But one of the great myths of the 18th, 17th, 18th, and indeed into the 19th century was that somewhere there was a tribe of Welsh Indians. So that when Lewis and Clark went out among the Mandan, or the Mandans, the Mandan, in 1805 or whenever it was, they thought they'd come upon them. They found this tribe who were speaking with a guttural Sacagawea, couldn't work out who they were. Anyway, these were the Welsh Indians. Madoc was the title of a long poem by the famous Robert Southey, who was at one stage poet laureate of England, and was interested in Indian, Native American Indian affairs, and wrote a poem about Madoc. Byron, as you know, had very little time for Southey, as Southey had very little time for him, and at every opportunity gets the boot into Southey. Southey, in return, described Byron, Tom Moore, Shelley, I think it was, as making up or certainly belonging to the satanic school of poetry. It's a little long preamble, I hope you'll forgive me for it. Southey and Coleridge also had this plan in the mid-1790s, were called pantisocracy, whereby they would come to North America, specifically to the somewhere along the banks of the Susquehanna, a name that they were taken by because of its, as one of them put it, its metricality, that they would come there and set up a little ideal community. And of course they didn't. In this poem they do, and that's what the poem is, kind of the spine of it is about. But it opens much later, a little later than even now. It opens sometime, I think, in the next century, early in the next century, with a descendant of Southey, whose name is South. I think he's a descendant of him. Sorry, this is a very long introduction to a very short poem again. What else should I say? Croatan or Croatoan was the word that was inscribed on the stick left by the lost colonists at Roanoke Island. Okay, you know more about this than I do. And this guy South feels that he's made some remarkable discovery about Coleridge and Southey, which of course is complete bunkum. Now the other complicating factor in all of this is that each section of this poem refers in some way, if ever it gets written, which it probably won't, refers in some way to the thought or the life, often in a very shallow, naturally, or casual way, sometimes less so, the thought or the life of a philosopher, beginning with the earliest Greek philosophers, with Thales, and coming right up to, if ever it gets written, I've written about half of it, to the modern day philosophers. Thales, as you know, believed that the earth was, and everything on it, was comprised mostly of water. And this poem begins in a bathroom, or a small room, as it's known in this society, where it's hot in here, isn't it? It won't take long. Where with all kinds of sophisticated surveillance techniques, all of which I think are available right now. Thales. The names of these guys should be thought of really as little subtitles rather than titles. Thales. When he ventured forth from the small room, he activated a sensor tile that set off the first in a series of alarms and sent a ripple through Unitel. He was running now. A frog scrawled across a lily pond, a kind of hopscotch frog. There'd be a 20-second delay. Then he'd almost certainly succumb to their cotton candy fuck foam. He'd only to whisper in Xanadu and smile at Kublai Khan. His voice count was still good. Then a retina scan. On the stroke of three, the door opened and all hell broke loose. There were geckos armed with Zens to either side. He let go of his old valise, which I suspect actually is the valise that was in 79th Street. It fell. And since there was nowhere to turn, he turned to the unruffled waist deep hedge with its furbelow of thorns and decollaged razor ribbon. One or two geckos began to applaud. He took the plunge, whereupon he became just another twist in the plot. Anaximander. These two guys are discussing what's just happened with South. Are you telling me that South was as free as a bird to wander through the dome, and it wasn't until he went to take a dump? Then we knew something untoward had happened. How? He weighed more rather than less when he left the crapper. Much more. Exactly as much as the scrap of paper we repossessed from his valise. Anaximenes. The geckos lowered their stun guns and looked askance when an omnipod scuttled along the scarp of trifoliate Chinese orange on which he'd whittled himself down to size. They could see this was no sanitine, but a wet set out for revenge. They heard him scream, the fluted cypresses reared up their living obelisks as a what's-it was clamped to his bond. Then an oxygen mask. And though one of his eyes was totally written off, he was harnessed to a retinograph. Pythagoras, these two guys again. It looked as if he'd simply transcribed the word from the Roanoke relic. The which? A worm-eaten rectangular plank or board they found somewhere on the outer banks at the turn of the century. It's under a sheet of imidlass in West 14, where South had limited right of entry. Exactly. But other than this word, Croatan, we drew a blank. Until we found his minuscule italic gloss in triple ink. Coleridge, Robert Southey, The Satanic School. The word Croatan appears in the middle of those letters. Heraclitus. And though it may seem somewhat improbable, all that follows flickers and flows from the back of his right eyeball. The rest of the poem you'd be glad to hear is not a bit like that. So I'll end with a poem about someone who disappears very suddenly as I'm about to. The word rig is a ridge or furrow. Why Brownlee left and where he went is a mystery even now. For if a man should have been content, it was him. 2 acres of barley, 1 of potatoes, 4 bullocks, a milker, a slated farmhouse. He was last seen going out to plough on a March morning, bright and early. By noon, Brownlee was famous. They had found all abandoned, with the last rig unbroken, his pair of black horses like man and wife, shifting their weight from foot to foot and gazing into the future. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much for coming. Those of you who would like to, please come join us in the upstairs of the English seminar room, where there are many pretzels to be eaten. Thank you once again, Paul.
Thank you.
No.